From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. With a resolution of the continuing uncertainty about the future of Greece and the EU once again postponed, with the International Monetary Fund's approval of Greece's request to bundle its four payments due during June into one at the end of the month, Greeks appear likely to continue pulling their money out of the banks. The Bank of Greece says Greeks have withdrawn around $35 billion, or nearly a fifth of all deposits out of the system, since January. CCTV's Filio Kontrafouri reports from Athens.
The Bank of Greece says savers have pulled around $35 billion out of banks since January. That's nearly a fifth of all deposits. Making matters worse, speculation that the government may impose capital controls to contain further withdrawals. One banking expert, Babis Papadimitriou, says a real bank run could turn catastrophic within hours. That's why he says Greece's time for an agreement is limited.
It's a matter of days or some weeks. But if an understanding is there, then we're going to have enough time to go into profound discussions for a new plan, for a new midterm plan, let's say 3 or 5 years. So by September or October, things might ameliorate quite a lot. But we need a government that is sure that what he's talking about is what he wants.
Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has rejected the latest reform proposals from the country's creditors. Now he has until June 30th, when the current bailout program expires, to steer Greece away from a cliff. Filio Kontrafouri, CCTV, Athens.
An unlikely pair, engaged in one of the world's most tightly guarded trysts, stepped out into the international spotlight in a big way Thursday, leaving gossipers agape and setting off a gaggle of wagging tongues among geopolitical observers around the globe. Saudi Arabia and Israel publicly admitted Thursday, in front of the Council on Foreign Relations and with the media present, that they've been meeting secretly to make common plans to destabilize and perhaps militarily attack Iran. Serious observers of the Middle East have long known that Israel and Saudi Arabia see a common interest in thwarting Iran, which each views as a regional rival. But Thursday's meeting was the first public acknowledgement by either of them of actual diplomatic contact between the two countries. Officially, Saudi Arabia still doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist, and that position is extremely important politically, both within Saudi Arabia and also among other Arab nations. And Israel continues to refuse a Saudi proposal for a Palestinian state. Both Saudi Arabia and Israel have proxies in a number of local conflicts, including Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, among others, even as both Saudi Arabia and Israel act as proxies for the U.S. and NATO. Both see Iran as their common adversary in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Eli Lake, writing for BloombergView.com, reported that at Thursday's event, there was a speech in Arabic from Anwar Majed Eshki, a retired Saudi general and former advisor to the former Saudi ambassador to the U.S. That was followed by a speech in English by Dori Gold, a former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, slotted to be the next director general of Israel's foreign ministry. While the two men represent countries that are officially enemies, Gold said their message was identical. Iran is trying to take over the Middle East and must be stopped. He said that Israel and Saudi Arabia were enemies because, quote, Saudi Arabia was financing and fundraising for the murder of Israelis, close quote. According to Lake's article, Gold said that Iran is now the one primarily working with those Palestinian groups. Meanwhile, as the Saudi war on Yemen continues, the UN Humanitarian Office, OCHA, said over 20 million people there are now in need of some form of humanitarian assistance. Daniel Dickinson has more.
The 20 million people in need of humanitarian assistance include around 1 million who fled their homes during May and the end of March. The population of Yemen is just under 25 million. OCHA said the number of displaced is expected to increase further over the coming weeks if the conflict continues. Spokesperson Jens Lerke said the death toll is also increasing.
Over 2,200 people have lost their lives. Half of them are civilians, and nearly 10,000 have been injured, according to our updates also at the end of May. These estimates are considered conservative and preliminary.
The UN has said it's working intensively to bring Yemeni parties together in Geneva as soon as possible for political consultations in the hope of ending the conflict. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
China has always been a peace-loving country. We have successfully walked on a road of peaceful development. We are now walking on a new road of win-win cooperation. China will never follow the footsteps of other big powers that sought hegemony once they grew strong. China has been and will continue to be a stalwart defender of our own national sovereignty and safety, and faithfully safeguard global fairness and justice, as well as actively facilitate international peace and development.
That was Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, responding to U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Russell, who questioned China's landfill projects in the South China Sea Wednesday. Russell also called on South Korea to join Washington in demanding that Beijing stop the construction projects. But South Korea, which just signed a major trade agreement with China earlier in the week, has been reluctant to join Washington in an attempt to thwart the pet project of Seoul's new trading partner, as Hwang Sung-yi from Korean television station Arirang reports.
Speaking at a seminar in Washington on Wednesday, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Russell slammed China's land reclamation projects in the South China Sea. Pointing out that Korea is not directly involved in the dispute, Russell said Seoul has all the more reason to speak out because it's speaking not in self-interest but in support of universal principles. He added Korea must assume the role of a major stakeholder in the international order. This is the first time a senior American official has asked Seoul to get involved, and it comes as Washington steps up pressure against Beijing on this issue. Last week, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter urged Beijing to immediately halt its island-building activities in the South China Sea. U.S. officials say China's reclamation efforts have sped up, creating artificial islands that have expanded by 1,500 acres since last year. On Thursday, Seoul's foreign ministry expressed hopes for a peaceful resolution to the dispute, but maintained its distance on the matter.
Our government hopes for peace and stability in the South China Sea by a complete and effective implementation of the Declaration on the Conduct of Parties in the South China Sea and a swift changing of the code of conduct between China and the ASEAN countries.
Some say President Park Geun-hye's trip to Washington later this month could be an opportunity for U.S. President Barack Obama to bring up the issue again. If so, the territorial disputes may put Korea in a very difficult position between its two superpower partners. Hwang Sung-yi, Arirang News.
On Friday, China's ambassador to the U.S., Kui Tian-kai, said that China's activities in the South China Sea are not and should not be an issue between the two countries. He said China has the right to pursue its present course.
What China is doing there is fully within the scope of our sovereignty. So there's nothing for others to get worried. Besides, this is not an issue and should not be an issue between China and the United States, because the United States has no territorial claims in the region. The status quo has been changed by others for a long, long time. So what we are doing is to sort of restore the status quo as it should be. The United States was the first country in the world to set up such zones. And there are now over 20 countries who have already set up such zones. So China certainly has the right to do the same. But whether we'll do it or not will be based on our assessment of the situation, and we will certainly do it with caution.
Russia's ambassador to the UN on Friday said there was growing irritation with Kiev among Western leaders for its repeated failure to fully implement the ceasefire agreement signed in Minsk in February. Vitaly Churkin said ahead of a UN Security Council meeting on the crisis in Ukraine that he would detail Kiev's violations of the political and military aspects of the Minsk agreements.
Mr. President, we are discussing the situation in the Ukraine since February 2014 and the 20, February last year, there was an agreement between the president and the opposition at that time. Now, if it had have been had been implemented, then by the end of the last year, Kiev would have held constitutional reform, and we would have observed a gradual normalization and a democratic development of Ukraine. Instead of this, a different logic has been in force, by people who wanted to have their political preferences for the future of Ukraine and the entire population. This is the root of the tragic situation, which has gone on for too long. And we need to put an end to this. And this is why the Minsk Agreement exists. Mr. President, we are grateful to the Under Secretary General, Mr. Jeffrey Feltman, and the Deputy Chief Monitor of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, Mr. Hook, for their briefings. We share the great concern at the resurgence of military activity in Donbass. We need to take measures to stabilize the situation. In this regard, we welcome the efforts of the OSCE and the Joint Center for Control and Coordination. The package of measures for implementing the Minsk Agreement adopted on the 12th of February give a concise and clear roadmap for settling the Ukrainian crisis. The Security Council unanimously supported that document in Resolution 2202, assuming its part of political responsibility for settling the situation in Ukraine. Therefore, here in the Security Council, we need to deal with the causes of the ongoing escalation. Since 12th of February, almost 4 months have gone by, and what has been done for implementing the package of measures? Pursuant to paragraph 4, on the first day after the withdrawal of heavy armaments, a dialogue should have begun on the modalities for conducting local elections in line with Ukrainian legislation and laws on the special status of Donbass, which was adopted back in the autumn of 2014. The Parliament of Ukraine was only required to adopt a statement law on this territory with regard to its special status. Now, instead of this, the Ukrainian Parliament has introduced amendments which were not agreed with Donetsk and Lugansk and which were not acceptable to them, and the territory itself was declared to be occupied. This turned on its head the agreement reached in Minsk. Amendments were simply overlooked the adoption of the special status and didn't provide for local elections. The Kiev's rhetoric is becoming toughened, and they said that the election could only take place once southeast of the Ukraine was under their full control. And over all this time, Kiev has refused to have direct dialogue with the representative of Donbass. And this is provided for in paragraphs 4, 9, 11, and 12 of the Minsk document. This is one of the clear reasons for the difficulty in unlocking the negotiations in the contact groups and subgroups.
Before the meeting, Churkin had stressed that he was under no illusion that the Security Council would manage to issue a joint statement after the discussion, and he was right. Meanwhile, as we previously reported, Russia's President Vladimir Putin will meet with Pope Francis on June 10th at the Vatican. Putin is also expected to visit Russia's pavilion at the Expo World Fair in Milan. For decades following the reign of former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, U.S. foreign policy has been largely directed by the thinking of two men, former Carter administration national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and billionaire financier George Soros. Both have favored a consistently hostile U.S. foreign policy, directed in particular against Russia and China. But, according to a number of international observers, recent events may be causing the elites in the U.S. to rethink this. One such observer is Umberto Pascali, an Italian writer and independent analyst based in Washington, D.C. We spoke with him Thursday via Skype from Washington. This is part two of that interview.
Today, the sad news, first that Putin would go to Italy to see the Expo in Milan, the famous Expo in Milan. But then, you know, being in Italy, he will be received by the Pope. The Pope said that he has a great benevolence toward Russia, and he wants to discuss in depth the problem, a sea solution, and so on. Strange language.
Huh? Yeah, you know, there's an interesting symmetry here too, because it was the Pope that was very heavily involved in the fall of the Iron Curtain. Karol Józef Wojtyła, the so-called Polish Pope, became Pope around a year or so before Brzezinski set off on the Afghan adventure. It was essentially when he and Carter were becoming firmly entrenched in you know, in Washington.
And that's done. This is an interesting point you're making. First of all, because you know how Wojtyła was elected. Before him, there was the Cardinal Patriarch of Venice that was elected, Albino Luciani. He lasted 1 month, then right. He strangely died.
Right. And there's all kinds of theories on that, right.
And the previous Pope, Paul VI, accused to be a Pope with the leftist sympathy, absolutely absurd, but, you know, that's the way of thinking of the Vatican, of the American Embassy in Via Veneto in Rome. He also died of basically broken heart because his political protege, Aldo Moro, had been kidnapped by the Red Brigades, quote unquote,
right.
And kept 1 month and then killed and let be found in the middle of Rome after he had even done an appeal, men of the Red Brigades, don't kill this just man and so on. There was a big war. There was a big war inside the Vatican, outside. Now, without going for all the detail, the point was they were preparing for the post Soviet world.
Right.
Until then, there was, you know, East and West, free world and communism, and Europe had to be divided. You know, the division of Europe, and you remember the famous slogan of the first secretary of NATO when he was asked what the NATO is for. Well, the NATO is to keep the American in, the Russia out, and the German down.
Right.
Now, if you substitute the Germans with Europeans, then you have a clear picture of what NATO is for. And so at that point, there was the illusion that Europe could be independent and you could really have a relation, economic, and cultural of all the Eurasian continent, an integration of all the Eurasian continent. That is the most natural thing, you know.
Right.
De Gaulle was saying that Europe goes from the Alps to Ural. Putin is saying from Vladivostok to Portugal.
Right.
But, you know, it's a continent there. And, you know, for centuries this has been prevented. Now, the idea was that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, after the end of this communism and the communists, then this thing was possible, this integration was possible.
Right.
And then a series of accident, a crisis happened. And at that time, the policy of the Vatican with Wojtyła was a lot in the, you know, they choose a Polish Pope, a clearly, you know, Polish Pope. Now, I don't want to compare Wojtyła to Brzezinski, of
right.
course. But, you know, the idea was, okay, policy will be to take care of Russia. Now, he could have taken care of Russia in two ways. One, the Russians themselves, the elite of Russia, want to basically de-Sovietize themselves.
Mm.
They were, but de-Sovietize with the soft landing and then to have all the economic benefits and so on. It has been discussed also in the Vatican since the previous Pope, since the Pope before John the 23rd, for example, that had all this contact with the family of Khrushchev, you know, the daughter and the son-in-law of Khrushchev.
Right.
But this was discussed. But on the other side, someone didn't want the soft landing. And this was the group of Brzezinski. At that time, their operative in Rome was Michael Ledin. You know? And there was a serious, this will be too long to deal with it now.
Right.
There was a lot of fighting, a lot of provocation. And until recently, the Vatican has been a battlefield. You know, the fact that one Pope had to resign, you know, first time in history,
right.
Second time in history,
right.
It's unbelievable. But in my opinion, this is just the consequence of a bigger fight. And this fight is, should the power, the Anglo-American power, the financial Anglo-American power, this immense power for the moment, this immense power, should continue to use this method of war and basically blood and dirty tricks to conquer and loot the world, or someone will stop it. Now, the coalition has also now this element, this religious institutional element, beside Russia and some of the European countries.
So, I mean, you have been seeing in development now for a good period of time an actual global response. You made reference to the BRICS, for example. On the ground, you've seen regional integration develop very rapidly in the last 15 years in Latin America and the Caribbean, and also in Asia. And China and Russia, but China particularly, getting heavily involved in building the infrastructure for themselves for the next period, planning to do tremendous amounts of trade and other interaction with people in with the region in Latin America and also elsewhere in Asia and Africa. Is this the thing that's driving, you think, the need on behalf of the elite here to retool and reorganize? And secondly, given the internal dynamics of their own system here, isn't some kind of a collapse inevitable anyway, no matter what tactic they follow?
Yeah. The key point is, when we talk about economy in China, when we talk about economy in the United States, there is a big difference. The Chinese, as you were saying, are building big, gigantic infrastructures. They are doing what the U.S. did last century, at the beginning of last century, or in the post-war period, immediate post-war period. This infrastructure is the secret of a strong economy. Strong economy is not you do tricks, you sell something, and then you invent some special advertising. No, you have to create the infrastructural basis. If you create ports, cities that work, roads, transportation, railways, and everything that is the base for then having production and having a superior level of life, then you have the future. You know, you invest and you have the future. The U.S. has done the opposite. Under this insane criminal gang in Wall Street that thought that you can make money out of money, they abandoned the old model that more or less the United States had. You build stuff, you build the real economy, and went for, financial services, and the rest is looting. Right. So we have in the United States, the old infrastructure cannot keep up with the time, and bridges are collapsing, roads are useless, and the cities, metro systems, and so on, are in a potential chaos. There is any plan to do anything about it? Absolutely not. Again, the idea is we have a financial service in Washington. We have our dogs of war, with the Soros, Brzezinski, Nuland, and so on. We loot the world. We don't need it. We have children producing shoes in the jungle of Indonesia for maybe the cost of $1. And then we put a name, a brand on it, and we sell for $100. That's the secret. So there is now, beside the fact that there is a counter coalition, there is an alternative with the BRICS, with China, with Russia, and other people, because now also, for example, Afghanistan and Iran are becoming members of the BRICS. But there is a problem for the U.S., even more serious, that they don't have an economy, and they cannot base themselves anymore on looting or using the dollar, printing dollar and pretend to be paid, because people are using other currencies. This is the real problem that, people should think, people in, even politicians that until now are just obeying the order, whatever was the slogan that was transmitted to them by TV of what Brzezinski and the the clique wanted that they would obey. Now they should think in a different way. How do we save our people from this?
And even today, this afternoon, the news is coming out of Brussels that Greece plans to miss its 300 million IMF payment tomorrow, 300 million euro IMF payment. And Prime Minister Tsipras said yesterday, we have the money to make the next couple of payments. I assume that that is money that would come from either Russia or China, because he's been speaking very heavily with them over the past few weeks. Is Greece possibly going to be a pivot point over the, you know, as this ebb and flow takes place between the U.S. and Europe on the one hand and the BRICS on the other? Is Greece perhaps a pivot point? And is this maybe the moment of pivot?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think Greece is a unique singularity in this geometry. Now, there is no doubt. And I think that the cards that the Greek government, that Tsipras says in his sense, are not very much shown in public. But, you know, the creditors, so-called, can understand what they are. They are already building a big pipeline, enormous pipeline. This is when talking about big infrastructure, right, comparable to the Trans-Siberian, just to have an idea. The Turkish stream or Balkan stream coming from Russia, going to Turkey, passing through Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Austria, Italy, rest of Europe. This is the gas that Europe needs and Russia has. But until now, with the Ukrainian crisis, Europe was prevented from having it because the Brzezinski company organized this horrible thing against the Ukrainian people. So now there is the new way, and this is this Turkish stream. Greece is in the middle. Already there is a deal with Russia that they will finance the pipeline in Greece, and they will pay with the royalty that they will have after building the pipeline. So this is a concept difficult to understand for people who think all in terms of money. They are thinking in terms of real economy. You have a pipeline. The pipeline will bring this river of wealth in terms of energy, the base of any economy. This is a wealth in itself. So we will give you credit on the base of this wealth that you will have. There is no, you know, how much dollars, how much, you know, drachmas, how much euros you give it to me. No, there is an idea of a project that will produce wealth, and that will be an investment that will be helped. So now the negotiation between Greece and the creditors going on until now, I have followed this a little bit, and it's, in a sense, it's funny, because the creditors until now were screaming, if you don't do what we want, we will kill you, we will cut our credit and you will die. Right. And Greece apparently was not scared. Why Greece is not scared? Are they insane? They are not insane because they have an alternative. Right. The danger now, Don, is not that, because, you know, China could flood Greece with investment, literally flood. They already have a great interest in the port of Athens. But the danger is that the Soros and these other, you know, war criminals will organize some form of irregular warfare. I cannot imagine, you know, terrorism, destabilization, so on, and burn Greece. For them, it's better to burn Greece than to lose Greece. So it's a game in which you have to be very careful. It's a very delicate game. But, you know, the great sharks of Wall Street, the City of London, doesn't look like they are winning like some newspaper wants you to believe.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.